Attenzione, allarme qualità audio. Attenzione. Indipendentemente dalla nostra volontà, l'audio di questo podcast non è qualitativamente eccelso. Ciò nonostante, la redazione di Fantascientificast ne ha scelto ugualmente la distribuzione, poiché i contenuti sono interessanti ed il livello dell'audio non pregiudica la loro comprensibilità e fruizione. Ringraziamo fin d'ora i nostri pod ascoltatori per la loro pazienza e comprensione.
Scotty, we need power.
Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia.
Sei interessato alla letteratura weird e horror? Marginalia potrebbe fare per te. Due giorni di libri e incontri a ingresso gratuito in cui scoprire i mondi dell'editoria indipendente e self-publisher, ambasciatori del fantastico, bizzarro e perturbante. 29 e 30 marzo 2025, alla Casa dei Giochi, via Santo Guzzone 8 a Milano.
Allora, dopo aver festeggiato in un certo senso la parte letteraria della fantascienza, cominciamo adesso con il primo panel della parte, diciamo, televisiva cinematografica, poi ci sarà un panel scientifico e dopodiché chiuderemo la giornata con il secondo attore ospite. Vi ricordo che subito dopo, cioè prima di cena, ci sarà la sessione autografi, quindi saranno anche in vendita le foto qui degli attori, se le volete comprare, tutto quanto come al solito. Allora, dunque, un piccolo aneddoto. Vi ricorderete che l'anno scorso è stato nostro ospite David Nicol. A un certo punto David Nicol mi manda una mail e mi dice: guarda che io avrei un ospite perfetto per la vostra convention. Ho detto: va bene, chi è? E dice: guarda, è un attore con cui io ho lavorato in Stargate, ci siamo appena rivisti, eccetera, eccetera. E quindi mi sono trovata questa mail nella posta di questo attore che mi diceva che gli sarebbe piaciuto moltissimo venire in Italia, anche perché ama moltissimo il nostro paese, cosa che è avvenuta. Quindi sono molto molto contenta, il passaparola come al solito da noi funziona molto bene. Questa volta quindi non è merito di Lolita, ma è merito di David Nicol, e quindi abbiamo il primo attore ospite di questa edizione, lo conoscete soprattutto per le tre serie di Stargate, ovviamente, Gary Jones.
Yes, that's the timer. A big round of applause for Flora. Thank you so much for having me and for being here. And this is just amazing to be in Italy speaking to you all. It's an honor to be here at DeepCon. That was the longest introduction I've ever had. Flora said, I am going to introduce you, and then you come in. And I said, okay. And I've almost finished my wine because she spoke for so long. I have no idea what Flora told you about me. No, stop, Flora, stop. You've had your time, Flora. You're done, okay. But I had to just, since she was talking in Italian, I had to just wait to hear what was being said, and I heard Stargate, so I knew that was the show. And my name, so great. So I'm here, thank you again. I've never been to a convention before like this, where there's so much heart, soul, and love, and connection between people. It's wonderful. So please give yourself a round of applause for welcoming myself and my partner to DeepCon. It's really lovely. I should ask, how many people, before I just assume that you know about me or the show, how many people just by applause even know the show? Let me say it in Italian, Stargate. No, Stargate. Oh, is it Stargate? I thought you said Stargate. No? Well, I'm going to call it Stargate because it sounds more Italian. In Germany, it's called SG Commando, which is, I didn't know until I saw the posters. But how many people, are you familiar with the show? Do you know the show? Just applaud if you have. Five of you. Okay, good. That's enough for me to talk. So then I'll tell you a little bit about myself and being on the show and what it was like, and then hopefully there's some time and you can, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask me any questions you like about being an actor or being on the show, anything you like, and if I can answer it, I will. And if we don't have time, because there are other people after me, stop me at the spa and we can chat. We can chat. I'll be the one in a robe, okay? So back when I was told in North America that they were making a television show about Stargate, my agent told me to go and audition, and she said, have you seen the movie Stargate? And I said, yes, I saw it a long time ago. And she said, well, they're going to take the movie and make it into a television show. I said, okay, great. And she said, you're going to audition for the part of the man who opens and closes the gate, a technician. So, great. And she said, but she said, don't screw it up. Do not, I don't know why she said this one time, but she said, don't screw up this audition. making it sound like I used to screw up my auditions, which I didn't, but she said, don't screw up this audition because this character may come back, may recur to other episodes. In Canada, if you do two episodes of any show, two, you have recurred. That's a recurring role because you appeared and then they brought you back, so you recurred. So that is usually what most actors in Canada think of as recurring, a recurring role. At the end of 10 years, which I had never imagined ever that I would be on Stargate for 10 years, I recurred in 107 episodes, which was beyond my imagination. I couldn't, it's just like impossible. And each time I did an episode, my agent would call me and say, they've written you into the script. Are you available? And I would say yes, every time. And so that's how I just did more and more. So do you remember, if you're familiar with the show, you know that my character opened and closed the gates. And I had to count the chevrons that lit up around the gate, right? Chevron 1, chevron 2, chevron 3, and so on. When I auditioned, they gave me a little piece of script to act with. And my only lines in the entire audition were chevron 1 encoded, chevron 2 encoded, chevron 3 encoded. That was it. That's all I had. But in between my lines, they would cut away to Richard Dean Anderson or Michael Shanks, and they were firing machine guns, and there were action scenes. And then they would come back to me, and I would say, chevron 4 encoded. And then they'd cut away, and there would be an action scene, and they would be almost dying and saying, we've got to get out of here. And chevron 6 encoded, back to me. I had no idea when I auditioned what a chevron was. So I actually had no idea what I was saying. I didn't know what the words I was saying meant. All I was doing was saying them. I also didn't know what the tone of the show was. I didn't know if it was really dark or scary or just action or funny. I had no idea because it was the pilot episode that I was going to be in. Sometimes when you audition for a show, the show is already in production. So you've seen the show, you know what the show is, you kind of have an idea how to act in the audition. I had no idea. So I thought, I have to do something interesting for the producers to make myself different to the other actors auditioning for this part. Do you understand? And if I say anything, if I'm speaking too fast, put your hand up. Tell me to slow down. If I say anything that you don't understand or is a term I use or anything like, please put your hand up and ask me to explain it. I want to make sure that you understand what I'm talking about. So when I went to the audition, I walked into the room and the director was there. And it turns out, as luck would have it, I had worked with the director before. And I walk into the room, and he sees me, and he goes, oh my God, it's you! You'd be perfect for this! Perfect! That's a good sign. That's a good sign that the director, because you're going to make his life easy. because he knows you, he's worked with you, and he likes you. So the best, already that was a great sign. So I walk in, and he says that, and I go, hey, Mario. And he goes, oh, my God, it's you. And I go, it's you. And then we fall in love, and I'm just waiting to get hired. But, of course, I have to audition. So the producers are off to the side, and he is there. And then I read my lines, and I think, I have to make them interesting. I have to do something with Chevron 1, Chevron 2, Chevron 3. So the only thing I know is that my background was as a comedian. That was it. I learned when I got into acting, when I became a performer, I was a comedian doing improvisation, comedy improvisation. So that was what I knew, so I thought, that's what I'll do. So I made my part in the audition comedy. That was it. So when they came, when my lines came, I said, Chevron 1 encoded. And then they came back to me and I said, Chevron 2 encoded. And then it came back to me and I said, Chevron 3 encoded. And then I built it up, and I built it up. And so by the time I got to Chevron 7 locked, which was the line that I say all the time, I literally said it like Jerry Lewis. And I said, Chevron 7 locked. That was how I delivered my action adventure science fiction line. And I looked over, and the producers were like this, just laughing so hard. But I had no idea that that's not what they wanted. I just did it anyway. And when I looked over and saw them laughing, my comedy, the impulse said, that's a good sign. It wasn't. I was completely wrong. And when I left the audition, the director walked me to the door, and as I'm leaving, I looked at him and I said, so good, right? Was that good? And he said, oh, yeah, but not that big. Too big, he told me. And then he just closed the door on me. And I stood in the hallway just going, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that. And that was it. And yet, they called me back one more time. I auditioned again, and they hired me. I couldn't believe that they hired me. But they told me later, the producers told me later, we hired you because you were the only one who did something interesting. You were the only one, even though it's completely wrong and had nothing to do with the tone of the show, you were so way off, but we liked that you just took a chance and did something, because I guess everybody before me just said Chevron 1 encoded, Chevron 2 encoded, and just bored them. So thankfully, I did the wrong thing, but I got hired. So good. I did the wrong thing, but I did good. Exactly. And so I wouldn't go back and change it, because that got me the job, you know? So I was very happy to be hired. On the first day of shooting, that director, if you've watched the show, the first episode is a two parts, and it's chaos in the gate room, because aliens come through and there's machine guns and firing and people are dying and being shot. But in order to get there, the director has to sort of organize lots of actors, lots of background people and everything. And so I come into the set at about 6 o'clock in the morning, very early, and they put me in the control room by myself in the dark. And they just said, wait here. Just sit here. And I said, okay. Because I assumed that we were going to film soon. And I was just, you know, it would happen very soon. I sat there all morning. And I kept asking the assistant director, when are they going to film me? And he said, oh, very soon, very soon. We'll get to you. We'll get to you soon. Didn't get to me. Didn't get to me. I was so tired sitting there in the dark looking at the gate room. I couldn't go anywhere. I said to the assistant director, can I go back to my trailer? No. Sit here. Then they say, now it's lunchtime. We're all going for lunch. So go for lunch. So I went for lunch. Big lunch. Come back. Now I've eaten. I feel like I'm at DeepCon sitting. I've eaten so much. Now I'm sleepy. I'm really tired. Still no filming. Finally, they move into the gate room. Finally, and I said, okay, great. This is going to be so good. But they weren't filming me. They were just in the gate room. And I was watching them. So now at least I had something to watch. But as I'm watching, I'm so tired that my eyes start stinging like they have sand in them. And I think, I'll just close my eyes for a second. I'll just close my eyes. I won't go to sleep. I won't go to sleep, but I will close my eyes because I'm in the dark and they're all lit. And I'm watching and I think, I'll just close. So I close my eyes and I close my eyes. Bear in mind, I have sat in that chair waiting since about 6:30 in the morning. It's now 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm exhausted. My eyes are I close my eyes for 10 seconds. And I just hear ping, and I wake up, and the director is staring up at me in this other room. And I look at him, and he goes like this. So in the middle of directing tons of action and extras and all the actors, he managed to look at me in the dark and see me with my eyes closed, which is the worst thing you can do, because it's an insult to him, because it's like, oh, you're falling asleep on my set. I had so much adrenaline in me in that moment that I was shocked awake. So I sat there. We then, you know, ended up doing a scene with me or whatever and went home. I was so frightened from having that moment where the director said, you know, like, that's a no-no, that I said, I will never, ever, ever do that again. Ever. The next day, I did it again. I could not believe that I did it again. So tired, early morning, no filming, sitting in the dark, waiting, waiting, waiting. Finally, they come in. I look at them, I say, I'll just close my eyes for a second. 10 seconds later, again, ping. And that ping, by the way, that sound, he had thrown a coin at the glass. He took out a coin and whipped it at the glass right in front of me, and he did it again the next day. I bolted awake, and he did this. Telling me that if that happens a third time, I'm done. That's it. I've had two chances. If I do it one more time, now I'm beyond freaked out. And I heard when I was more established in the show and I got to know some of the directors better, I found out that there had been talk of firing me for that. I almost lost the role because I looked like I was asleep twice. And the director, even though when I auditioned, he said, "Oh my God, it's you, I love you, you're perfect, oh!" He wanted to fire me. And the producers talked him out of it because they wanted me, but he was only directing two episodes, but they were going to be there the whole time. They wanted me, and they said, "No, we're not going to fire him." But he said, "Get rid of that guy." And they said, "No." And he was like, "Ugh." So that's how I was able to stay on the show for that long, but I could have been gone so early. That's how frail and, you know, you can go in a second. You can be gone, you can have your job, and you can be gone for any number of reasons. Another thing that over the course of the years that was really interesting to me was that when I first started this job, that when I would get a script, my title was just technician in the script. That was the title of my character. Technician. The thing about just being called technician and not having a name means that they can, if the producers want to, they can just get rid of you and they can replace you with another technician. But as I stayed with the show, then they kind of got to, they were like, "Okay, yeah, we like this guy," and they changed my title in the scripts to sergeant. I went from technician to sergeant. And I thought, "Oh, that's pretty good. I've been promoted. That's great. That's a good sign. Then, as time went by and more seasons happened, I got more promotions. And I went from technician to sergeant to Master Sergeant. Now I was at a good rank. Good rank. And I would say to them, "Why did I get promoted?" And they would say, "Doesn't matter, you just did." And I would say, "Yeah, but I just work in the control room. What did I do for you for my character to get promoted?" You know, because actors want to know what's behind my character, what's my motivation. And every time they would say, "Oh, you just did. You just got promoted." Okay, fine. Then they finally gave me a name, like a human name. And it was Master Sergeant Davis. And I was like, now if they want to kill me, they have to have a reason. They can't just get rid of me. They have to actually build it into the script. In other words, sort of telling the fans, that guy that was opening and closing the gate, the guy that you liked, he's gone. But we'll tell you why. Before, they didn't have to give a reason, then they had to. So I knew that means that in order to get rid of Master Sergeant Davis, it's more work for them. So it's a good sign. Then they added another name. They added my first name, Norman. They called me Norman Davis. So now I was Master Sergeant Norman Davis. Great. Getting more and more entrenched and, you know, in the show. Then they promoted me to Chief Master Sergeant. So that was as high as my character could go, because I was not an officer. I was called a non-commissioned officer. I didn't go to officer school. But that was the top that my character could go. Chief Master Sergeant Norman Davis. Okay, great. Then in an episode called 2010, which was, it was named, you know, the year 2010, the producers wrote it as the Stargate was a tourist attraction in the future. And I was a tour guide. My character was now a tour guide. Same, I was Norman Davis, the Stargate tour guide. The leads, the SG-1 team with Richard Dean Anderson and Michael Shanks and Amanda Tapping and Christopher Judge, had gone into the future. And they were at the control room in the future in the year 2010 when it was a tourist attraction. And in this scene where I meet them, they walk into the room, and we have to pretend like we kind of recognize each other. That's just how they wrote it. And I looked at Richard Dean Anderson, and I said, "Colonel?" Like I was remembering him. And Richard Dean Anderson looked at me, and he said, "Walter?" If you ever see that episode, and I've just told you about this moment, just know that when he said, "Walter," which was not my name, I thought that I had misread the script and that there was somebody behind me named Walter that I didn't know about or had forgotten about. But you can't, you just have to keep doing the scene. You can't stop. So he said, "Walter?" And I said, "Yeah, yes." And I'm thinking, what the hell is he talking about? So we do the scene, and the scene goes great. And they go, "Okay, cut, we're done." But then one of the crew went up to Richard Dean Anderson and said, "Rick, everything was great about that scene, except Gary's character is not named Walter, but you called him Walter. That's not his name." And Richard Dean Anderson, because he is the star of the show and the executive producer, said to them, "Well, it is now." Because Richard Dean Anderson did not want to reshoot the scene. So because of that, he just said, "Well, it was, you know, it's fine. I'm going to my trailer." His name is now Walter, leaving this trail of confusion and chaos behind him. So that the crew look around and go, "Oh my God, now he's Walter? What?" The writers get told that I am now Walter. So now my character is Chief Master Sergeant Norman Walter Davis. And when I'm as confused as anybody, but I keep showing up for work. Then in another episode shortly after that, do you remember the general, he was like, he had a big belly on him, and he was from the southern states, and I talk like this. General Hammond. Do you remember General Hammond? Okay, so General Hammond
He talked like this, and I was like, oh, everything you could hear, here we are at the Stargate.
You could barely understand him at the best of times. And General Hammond had one line in an episode after the Walter episode where he had to say to me, open the iris. So the iris was the Stargate. They referred to that as the iris, right? For those of you who've maybe never seen the show. And that would open the Stargate, and then the puddle would happen, and people would go through. So he was ordering me to open the iris, but because I was in the Air Force, he could refer to me as not just Sergeant or Walter or Norman or whatever. He could order me he could use the term airman because I was in the Air Force, airman. So they said, okay, action. And Don said, open the iris, airman. And they said, okay, Don, try that again. Open the iris, airman. Try it again, Don, because it didn't sound like the word airman. So they filmed it. They maybe did like six takes, okay, of Don trying to pronounce the word airman. Finally, they said, okay, thank you, Don. And from that, they thought Don pronounced the word airman like the name Harriman. And so that is how I got the name Walter Harriman. Because people weren't there to see Don try to say the word airman, and he couldn't. But this is what made me laugh so hard. It was actually easier. Can you imagine this decision on a massive production? And we're like seven seasons into the show, and it was easier for the producers to change my name to Harriman than to get Don to pronounce a word. I said, this is insanity. So for a very short while, I was Chief Master Sergeant Norman Walter Davis Harriman. Then finally, they had to make a decision. They said, well, now he has too many names. So they got rid of Norman Davis, and they decided to keep Walter Harriman. So if you look at photographs, I brought some photographs to make available to you. There may be a picture with my character with the name tag Davis, and another one with the name tag Harriman. Same character, same guy, same person, same job, completely different names. And the fans had no idea. Every convention I've gone to, they've said, what's with the names? Why did your names change? And I told them that, and they could not believe it. They couldn't believe that that's how my name changed. So that's a little sort of background for you guys if you ever see the show and you've ever wondered what that was about. That's what that was about. What time are we at? 21:31. So I am at, so I'm finished at 6. I just want to make sure. 6? 6, something like that. Okay. All right. Well, right now, let me just stop for a sec and ask, does anybody have any questions about anything about the show or acting or anything? I'm happy to answer. Of course it's Flora. 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 Great question. My first convention. So just understand that I had no idea about the world of science fiction and science fiction fans, which I've come to obviously understand is a big world. It's important. Science fiction shows are important to the fans that love the shows. There was a convention that was held in Vancouver, and the organizers asked me to appear. They said, please come to the convention. And I said, no. And they said, why not? And I said, nobody. I said, because why do you want me there? Like, why? And they said, well, because the fans love your character. And I said, it was very hard for me to get that around my head, because I thought that the camera just went past me like that. I would say Chevron 1 encoded, and they were just, you know, that I was hardly noticed. So I thought, I didn't think that it was, that my character was a big deal, but apparently it was. So I finally said, okay, I'll go. And I went to this convention, and when I walked into the lobby of the hotel, there was a group of fans, and they screamed. I was like, are you kidding me? You have to be kidding me. There's no way. But they, and the funny thing was, I've just told you a story about all my name changes over 10 years, but this was in the early part of the show, and they pointed at me and they said, it's the Chevron guy. So because they didn't know my name, they just named me. So for many years, I was Chevron guy. And so then it was my first experience with volunteers. And I know that anytime you come to a convention, the key to a great convention are the volunteers, the organizers and the volunteers. So yes, absolutely. I have become well aware of this. And so I always want to point out how great the volunteers are, because they run the show. So, but I didn't know that when I first came to the first convention. They gave me a man with a headset and a walkie-talkie on his belt. And I think it was the first time in his life that he ever had a headset and a walkie-talkie. And he loved it. He loved the fact that he had a headset and a walkie-talkie. So I said, can I go to the green room? And he said, come with me, Gary, and I'll take you up to the green room. So we went up to the green room on the second floor, where all the other actors were inside. And this is where I knew that it was his first day with a walkie-talkie. He didn't knock on the door. There was no one in the hallway, just me and him. And instead of just knocking on the door, he talked on his walkie-talkie. And I could hear him saying, I'm out. He said, this is, you know, Dale. I'm out in the hallway with Gary Jones. And then there's a pause. And then he says, Gary Jones. I'm in the hallway with Gary Jones. I'm outside. Can you come and open the door? And then there's another pause. He says, I'm in the hallway. I'm in the hallway with Gary Jones. And I said to him, why don't you just knock on the door? And he said, this was the line he used through the whole weekend. Gary, please, let me do my job. That was his line, and I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And every time I would sort of suggest something to him, he'd say, Gary, just let me do my job. So they finally came to the door and, you know, let me in, whatever, and met some of the other actors that I knew. And after a few minutes, I said to him, oh, I'm just going to go to the bathroom. I just need to go to the bathroom. And he said, oh, okay. Then he got on the walkie-talkie, and he told the entire crew
I'm with Gary and he needs to go to the bathroom. And I said, you don't have to tell everybody that I need to go to the bathroom. And he said, Gary, just let me do my job. And I said, okay, fine. I was starting to get it. And then he called two more volunteers. So now there's him and two ladies. And we leave the room. He's in front of me, and they're beside me. And we are marching to the bathroom. And he's in front of me saying, make way, make way. And I cannot believe that I'm in this situation. And then and fans are just kind of going like this for us to walk by. And if I try to be incognito or, you know, there's no way. He brought so much attention to me. If I had gone by myself, I would have been fine. He made such a big deal out of it. So we get to the bathroom in the hallway, and the two ladies go on either side of the door, like guards. He says to me, come on, Gary, come with me. We go into the bathroom, and, you know, there's like cubicles, right? He does this. To make sure that no fans are lurking if they know that I'm going to the bathroom. And when he finds the stalls empty, he says, okay, Gary, go ahead. And then I stand and pee while he stands nearby. And then we leave and we go back and the same thing. Make way, make way. And that was my very first experience at a convention. And I thought, this is just insane. It's mental. But, and so I've gone from that to Flora, who, when I say, what am I doing? She says, just have some pasta and some wine and show up when you feel like it. Which is so relaxed. I can go to the bathroom by myself. I have come that far that I can go to the bathroom by myself and nobody bothers me. And Flora has not once said to me, Gary, let me do my job. Which is great. What else can I tell you? It's 10-2. Any other questions? Anybody, anything about Stargate acting? Anything? Yes. Yes, sir. Right. So the question was, have I gone behind the camera and done any directing? Well, there's an interesting story to that that involves one of the other guests that is here today. So I'll tell you about that. My partner, Greta, most of you have met Greta. She's going to be talking tomorrow about costumes. That's what her specialty is. Greta has a son who's 26 years old, and he has challenges. So he has a little bit of cerebral. He was born with cerebral palsy. He has a bit of developmental delay, and he has a seizure disorder. So he has challenges, and he's 26. But he's also very high functioning, you know, he has a job, he has friends, you know, but he just has things that need to be taken care of, okay? So he belongs to an acting group in Vancouver called the Stage Door Players, and they put on shows once a year. But the reason I bring this up is because Elliot was born premature. He was 2 pounds. Okay, but now if you met him, he's 6'3". He's a tall guy. He's fantastic. I love the guy.
But his best friend is another actor who comes up to about here on him, okay? So one day, I was looking at the two of them, and I thought, they remind me of these two characters in a famous play called Of Mice and Men. And there are two characters, the main characters named Lenny and George. And Lenny and George, if you know the play, it's during the Depression, and they're going from farm to farm trying to get work, and it's a very, very heartbreaking play, very heartbreaking. And I looked at them one day, and I thought, wow, suddenly they remind me of Lenny and George. I was looking at them walking in front of me, and I thought, wow, Lenny and George. And then I thought, I wonder if they could be Lenny and George on stage. And then I thought, well, why not? Why can't I direct them? Why can't I do that? So the first thing I did was I went home and I talked to Greta and I said, what do you think about this idea? Like, I've just had this thought about Elliot and Isaac being Lenny and George in a play. And Greta loved the idea. Then I talked to Isaac. He said, oh my God, that would be so great. And then I talked to Elliot, and Elliot kind of liked the idea. He thought, oh, that's interesting. So we did the play. We actually did the play, but this was what the amazing thing was to me, is that I directed Elliot in his real life as a man with challenges, to play a character with challenges. And it was so great. It was probably one of the best things I've ever... one of the things that I've loved the most that I've done in my entire career was to do that. And we had to gather a bunch of other actors. And as soon as we told them, we said, look, we're going to do Of Mice and Men. One of the characters, the character playing Lenny, has challenges. Are you okay with that? And they were like, yes, I want to be in it. They didn't think twice about it. And it was so fantastic. Greta did, she might tell you about this tomorrow, I don't know, but she did the costumes. It was so wonderful. But I'll tell you, there was a moment when I was directing him that I had... like a light bulb went off in my head. I had been directing Elliot, and he would, if he was in a scene and he had a line and he was talking to somebody and they said something to him and he would answer them, and then he would just kind of look around. And if I was sitting over here, he would look at me. And I kept saying, Elliot, don't stop looking at me. I'm in the audience. Stop, don't look at me. Look at that guy. And he was like, oh, okay. And then he kind of got him. But he couldn't stop looking away. And then one day I just realized, oh, wait a minute. That is Elliot's version of Lenny. And it was such a profound moment for me, because I sort of stepped into something. Like I went somewhere else, and I understood something on a deeper level to let him do that. And then I realized I was watching Lenny, not Elliot. So it was fantastic. Yeah. It was really lovely. I was, makes me very emotional. He was so wonderful. And not only that, but this is how great he was in that role. He had to do a scene with Isaac, and Isaac had a coughing fit. He just coughed, and Elliot looked at him and said, are you okay? Not in the script. And Isaac just said, yeah, I'm good, thanks. And that was the nature of the relationship. It was so honest. You just can't, you had to see it to experience it. It was so fantastic. Yeah. I can't talk about it anymore because I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry. I don't know what else to tell you about Stargate. Yeah? Oh, did I work with anybody famous? Yes, I've worked with like outside of Stargate. I've worked with a number of famous people, and I will tell you one that you'll probably all know. Do you know the actor Mickey Rooney? You all know Mickey Rooney. Okay, great. So Mickey Rooney, when I found out that I was going to work with Mickey Rooney, I thought the most important thing was for me to get a picture of myself with Mickey Rooney, and I don't normally do this, but I needed to show my parents at the time that I was getting work and I was acting, because they lived across the country from me, and they would ask me, "How are you doing?" And I would say, "Yeah, I'm doing fine." But when I got hired to be in the television show of The Black Stallion, you know, the movie that Francis Ford Coppola directed, the movie that Mickey Rooney was in, they made a television show of it in Vancouver, and Mickey Rooney was playing the same part. And I got hired in one episode to be the vet, the horse veterinarian. And a really good friend of mine was working as an assistant director on the show. And his name was Mike. And I called him up and I said, "Mike, I just got cast in The Black Stallion. I'm going to be on the episode. I need you to take photos of me with Mickey Rooney when I'm on set." And he said, "Okay, but I'll just tell you one thing. Mickey is, if you don't get those photos quickly, he will be gone." And I said, "Mike, he's 90. He's 90 years old." And Mike said, "No, you don't understand. You have to be here to witness what Mickey Rooney is like and the energy that Mickey Rooney has. It's not of this world." So I said, "Okay, fine, but just make sure that you take photos." So when I got on set, I had, like any actor would, I had all my lines memorized, right? I'm waiting. So I get there. Mickey is not on set. He's late. And because Mickey could be late, it was his show, he could do what he wanted. Thankfully, he didn't rename me he didn't give me a new name in the episode. But finally, when he showed up, you could hear it through the crew. It was like, "Mickey's here, Mickey's here, Mickey's arrived, Mickey's here." And there was this energy that went through the set. And then Mickey Rooney bursts onto the set, and he's like this tall. And he's a little guy, and he's just got crazy energy. And he comes in and he goes, "Okay, let's start." And now everybody who has been waiting to start jumps into action. And they introduce me to him, and they say, Mick, this is Gary. Gary, this is Mick." And I said, "Hi, Mickey." And he said, "Call me Mick. Call me Mick." And I said, "Okay, Mick, great, nice to meet you." And then, again, I have all my lines memorized. Mick, says, "Who's got a script? Can somebody bring me a script?" And the script person handed him the script, and he did this. That was Mickey learning his lines in the moment, on the spot. I had no idea. I had never seen anything like this before, and I'm just looking at him, and he just kind of went, "Okay, good." Like him saying, "I have the gist. I kind of get the idea of the scene." But if you're an actor, you are waiting for cue lines. The cue line is the line that you hear. It's the last line before you say your line. So they start the scene. They go action, and Mickey just starts talking. I have no idea what he's saying. Not a clue. He just starts saying, Doc, there's something wrong with the Black Stallion. I don't know. I went there this morning. I couldn't figure it out. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm looking at him, and I know that he's talking to me as the vet character, and there's something wrong with the Black Stallion, but there is no cue line in sight. And then finally, he ends. He just stops talking, and he just goes... And there's a huge pause where I'm staring at Mickey Rooney. And I'm thinking, is that it? Is he done? Where's my cue line? And the director just yells, cut. Problem, Gary? You don't say in front of Mickey Rooney to the director, yeah, I have a problem. Mickey Rooney doesn't know his lines. So I say, oh, sorry, brain fart. I had a brain fart. I'm sorry. And they said, okay, all right, let's go again. Like I had just blanked. I just took it. I took the bullet for that one. Mickey pulls me aside and he says, hey, come here. Listen up, kid. He goes, this is how it's going to go. They're going to yell action, and I'm going to start talking. When I stop talking, you talk. And I didn't realize in that moment that I was getting the best acting lesson ever. I make fun of it now, but trust me, and I'm sure Bob O'Reilly will agree, that if that acting is about listening. Would you say, Bob? It's about listening. And Mickey Rooney essentially said to me, they're going to yell action, and you had better listen to me, because I have no idea what I'm going to say. But when I finish this pile of words, you say something. And I thought, yeah, that's like real life. If I showed up as a vet and the guy was telling me that he didn't know what was wrong with the horse, I'd just be listening to him trying to figure it out. And in later years, I realized, wow, that in that one sentence, that's like an acting masterclass. And that actors go to acting school to learn that. And he just told me that, and I went, and I said, got it. And then we did the scene, we did it a few times. Every time Mickey talked, he said something different. He just changed it. But the gist was, there's something wrong with the horse, and I don't know what it is. Can you figure it out? And I said, okay. And so we did it. Everything was great. So you have to understand, I worked with him for like maybe half an hour, looking into Mickey Rooney's crazy eyes. When they finally yelled cut and said, okay, we're done, Mickey took off. And I needed photos with him, right? I said, Mike, did you get any photos? Because he had my camera, and he said, kind of, but maybe you go and see if you can get some photos. So I went running after Mickey Rooney, and he was only gone 10 seconds, but he was like half a mile away. I couldn't believe how fast that guy could walk. So I'm running after him with my camera, and when I got to his and I saw him go up into his trailer, he was in his trailer for maybe 10 seconds. I arrived, he comes out, he's completely changed. I didn't know this, but my friend Mike told me later that all of Mickey Rooney's costumes could be torn off. They were all Velcroed down the side because Mickey did not want to waste a second getting in and out of clothes. So he would go into his trailer, tear off his clothes, and he was dressed underneath to leave. I thought it was like a Las Vegas magic act. I was, how did he change so quick? Anyway, that's how he changed. He came out of the trailer. Again, I'll remind you that I just worked with him for 20 minutes, and it was good. He saw me with the camera, and he went nuts. And he started swearing at me and going, oh, I can't believe it. And I can't say what he said, but just know that I was frozen. I couldn't, and he just went at me. He just started yelling, swearing, can't believe I had a camera, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, it's okay, Mick. It's fine. It's cool. Don't worry about it. And then he said, oh, just come here. Just get over here. And so then he gave the camera to a production assistant and said, take the photo. Take the photo. God damn it. And then he did this. Then he did this. That was Mickey's look. My look was like what they call the 1,000-yard stare from like Vietnam. It was like no one home, no one home. I don't know what had just happened. Then, I'll never forget this, the production assistant said, okay, one more for safety. Mickey went crazy. The second time. And then he got in his huge limousine singing the theme tune to Cats. As he got in, all I heard was Mickey going, memories all alone in the, as he drove off. And I just stood there in the dust with my camera and, you know, that was it. That was my experience working with Mickey Rooney. Am I done? Yes. Oh, my parents, yes. My parents, they got the picture and they said, oh, that's great. Wonderful, Mickey Rooney, thank you. And I almost said, you have no idea what it took to get that photo. You know? Oh my God. Thank you very much. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed. Hope you enjoyed that. Great to be here and talk to you. And thank you so much. And I think Bob O'Reilly's up next, so we're gonna. Oh, it's Marco, and oh, you two. Okay. Anyway, thanks again.
Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia. È un podcast originale Latitudine Zero, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafini, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof. Massimo De Santo, realizzato da Latitudine Zero Median Fabric. Showrunner Omar Serafini. Sound design Fabio Marchionni e Julian Ziegler. Post-produzione Gismar Boom. Creative producer Annalise Haas e Valentina Folkov. Coordinamento e promozione Veruska Sabucco. La voce di Val 9000 è di Valeria Barbera. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.com, sul profilo Instagram Fantascientificast, sul canale Telegram Fantascientificast e sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity, oppure scrivendoci all'indirizzo email redazione@fantascientificast.com. Tutti gli episodi sono disponibili gratuitamente sul nostro sito e su tutti i principali servizi di streaming on demand. Se volete sostenere il nostro progetto offrendoci una birra rumulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, troverete tutte le informazioni e modalità nell'apposita sezione del nostro sito. Il podcast non intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Val 9000 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento al prossimo episodio lungo la rotta di Kessel. E ricordate, la fantascienza finge di guardare dentro il futuro, ma in realtà guarda il riflesso della verità che è davanti a noi. Scientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.